Hi, welcome to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe. Well, we're really glad to have in the studio today Greg Lake, a former immigration officer who managed detention centres including Christmas Island, Kirsten in Western Australia, Shergar in far north Queensland and Nauru. He's also had experience in policy when it comes to asylum seekers and offshore processing. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, you've got a very interesting story because in the process of working, in the process of managing detention centres, as a Christian, you felt that you couldn't do this work anymore. So, spoiler for people listening out there, but we'll get to that shortly. But first, walk us through, when you started at Christmas Island, were things already sort of up and running, or did you have to kind of pull things together and streamline processes and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, look, I arrived in January of 2010, so the increase in boat arrivals had already, I guess, begun, but during the time I was on the island, the centre's capacity more than doubled. So we saw a massive, massive increase in the number of people in detention. I was there for things like the suspension of processing of Afghan and Sri Lankan applications for protection, the boat crash in December, all sorts of big events that really did have a huge impact on what we described in the industry as the mood of the centre.
Well, tell us more about that. So what's your role and how does it change depending on the, I guess, climate of the events that are happening around and that are, it's working, you know, on this very vulnerable population of people? I mean, what's it like being at the centre of that sort of storm?
The job is really about how do you provide for the needs of someone who is so vulnerable in an environment where they have very little control over their own circumstances and haven't even before they arrived. So you look at things like how do you provide adequate medical and mental health care? How do you provide the basic kind of, you know, food, water, shelter, that kind of thing, sports, activities, education services? You do a lot of that through contracting. So you contract out organisations like Serco, International Health and Medical Services, which do the clinic, and other kind of providers like that. But your day-to-day role is about actually spending time looking at the key issues at the centre, thinking about how different strategies and things that are going on in the centre are being implemented and what effect they're having on the well-being of somebody in the centre. As government policy changes, sometimes you have a role to play then in actually manipulating the mood of the centre or actually trying to create certain circumstances or environments that have an effect on people in detention. And that's the shift that I think I witnessed most graphically in the 4 years I was involved.
Can you give us an example of what you mean by that? How are you manipulating, I suppose, your words, the mood of the centre in order to affect government outcomes?
Initially, when I arrived, the big focus was on duty of care. So you want to provide an environment which avoids institutionalizations, which tries to provide for the needs, which looks out for the best interests of the person. And that looks, different in every centre and different depending on the person, really. So you spend a lot of time looking at individual cases and how can you provide for the needs of that individual, and then how can you do that for a lot of individuals at once. As the policy shifts occurred, and as the government moved to a more deterrent-focused environment where they were trying to make detention centres worse than the alternative, which is to not arrive, that is to stay in some transit country like Indonesia as an unlawful Indonesian resident, or in your home country where you were probably going to get killed, you begin to break down things like the way that you communicate someone's circumstances to them. What do you tell them about their immigration status? What are the messages you're sending about what sort of future they might have in that centre or beyond it? Are they going to come to Australia ultimately? Are they going to be resettled in the Australian community with full access to our universal healthcare system called Medicare? Are they going to be provided with housing in the Australian community? Will they be able to see their family in Australia? And if you take away each of those little things, or you take away information about each of those little things even, you begin to create an environment which is very controlling, but it's also very hopeless. And that hopelessness, or taking away those things, was a key strategy in creating the deterrence that I described just now.
So it's essentially breaking people's spirits. Is that a way to put it, or is that very melodramatic?
You would never see that in a government document, of course, but that is the effect of all of the different things that were done very deliberately in order to create that deterrence, yes.
Wow. And are they relying on, I don't know, people ringing their relatives and saying and describing what the conditions are like? Is that how the word gets out about how terrible the conditions are?
Word gets out a lot of ways, but there's no question that the information about circumstances in a detention centre is shared by those inside with people back home and people who are friends who are either in Australia already or in transit themselves. And so definitely the most effective mechanism of sending that deterrent is to have personal stories from asylum seekers in Nauru or on Christmas Island, sharing that with their family back home. Though the government did try other strategies, as we know, like advertising campaigns and things like that on social media and in local markets across the transit countries like Indonesia and Malaysia.
Do you mean like the, you know, they will not make Australia home style ones?
Those ones, yeah, that's right.
Now, when you talk about how you were there to manipulate the mood of the centre, and you said that you'd never see breaking people's spirits outlined in a government document, but this is effectively what's happening. How do you negotiate that? Like, you seem like a nice guy, but you also want to do a good job, presumably, right?
Well, I certainly wanted to do a good job, and I think that's, I guess, the effect. One of the things I suppose I should say is I'm not quite sure how deliberate or strategic that was. I think the department interpreted the no advantage principle and the deterrent strategy in certain ways and begun doing things that broke down hope because it was effective. I don't know if anyone would ever put their hand on heart and say that was a strategy we used deliberately, but it was certainly the strategy that was implemented, whether they liked it or not. And what I found was as that strategy moved from well-being of people in detention, looking at and providing care to them, to deterring people from following them, my comfort level with what my professional obligations were in implementing those policies became harder and harder for me to confront.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're talking to Greg Lake, who's reflecting on his experience managing detention centres on Christmas Island, Curtin, Shergar and Nauru. So, Greg, from the climate of hopelessness that in some ways was the outcome of implementing government policies to try and deter people from seeking asylum in Australia, when we think back to events on Manus Island that have been exceptionally tragic with the death of one young man, when you see that, I mean, you're no longer managing detention centres, when you see that happen and it's reported in the media, are you just like, that was just a matter of time?
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually more than just that example of that, actually. So there were some riots on Christmas Island in March of 2012. There were some riots, 2011. There were some riots on Nauru just last year. And then we've seen this incident here on Manus Island. And all of them are entirely predictable. If you get a group of really vulnerable people who've witnessed some really horrible things and who are suffering from the kind of torture and trauma effects, often PTSD, post-traumatic stress, and put them in a room small enough where they don't have any control over their environment, something's bound to explode. The people crack. And so all of these circumstances are circumstances which don't surprise me. And even if they're not sourced or don't start with the asylum seekers themselves, often it's something that someone does that would otherwise be relatively benign that creates a reaction. So I think what we saw on Manus was an example of an issue with the local political environment in Papua New Guinea, an issue with relations domestically within Papua New Guinea, an issue with an attitude towards asylum seekers from security staff, an issue of a lack of training, an issue of a no-care and no-responsibility attitude from the Australian government, which precipitated what was probably a relatively minor spark, and that turned into a big fire, if you like. And it's not surprising that someone died. It's also not surprising that the incident occurred in the first place, because we put all of the right things in place for it to happen, and then we shouldn't be surprised it does. In fact, I think that's the way a lot of commentators have started to understand it. They've said, look, this is the inevitable result of a policy which is supposed to create a bad environment, you get a bad environment.
So the government policy was successful in that sense?
It's entirely successful, which is, in my view, a tragedy. If this is how we go about achieving a policy outcome and it comes at the cost of some of the most vulnerable people's lives, then we need to revisit what works and how.
When did you first experience like a crisis of conscience about this? It sounds like it would have been pretty early on, is that right?
I wouldn't say on Christmas Island I'd even begun to confront the issue of whether there's whether we've got the appropriate policy on how to deal with boat arrivals. I think it was really when there was a guy up in Sherga at the detention centre in Cape York in Far North Queensland who took his own life one night. And as the coronial inquest went through, we really found out that this was a guy, 18 years old or so, under an immense amount of pressure from his family to pay off people smuggler debts and have his family brought out to Australia. So he was both depressed and in an institutionalised environment with all this pressure coming in from the outside and had an underlying history of mental illness. And it was a horrible story, a tragic story. And it was the first time when I went, wait, if we had different policies, he may never have reached that point. That was in 2011, early 2011, and I think it was then that I began to question what on earth was I doing involved in this thing. And then as I stayed and grappled with the question of is it better to have good people in roles like this so that we can at least try and make it better, and pitched that idea against the idea of saying, well, my own personal beliefs, my own faith, my own moral convictions are at odds with what I'm doing. And as I grappled through those things, I think the tension arose and developed and grew in me. And I eventually just had to say, look, this is it. I've got to go.
Can you just describe for us the moment when you were like, no, this has to stop?
The straw that broke the camel's back was on Nauru. And in the same space of a week, we had a situation where a man who had psychosis was assessed by a psychiatrist as needing to be medically evacuated to Australia. The decision to medically evacuate someone should sit with the Department of Immigration, an official who can say, look, on professional medical advice, this needs to happen, so we do it. But actually the decision was taken at a political level by the Minister for Immigration, and that decision took 48 hours, and during that time the man was sedated, receiving no treatment at all, which was horrific in itself. It's political involvement gone wrong when that happens. That happened in the same week that we had a group of eight people who'd sewn their lips to demonstrate the voicelessness of those on Nauru who'd been transferred offshore for processing or not processing, as the case may be. And the third event that happened that week was a series of demonstrations culminating in one guy trying to take his own life by jumping off a roof. He was tackled by a security officer who knew the man well, who effectively saved his life by tackling him to the ground so he couldn't jump off this roof. That security officer was then accused of assault and was stood down from his duties, even though the reason why he assaulted the guy was because he was trying to save his life. And the three of those things, each of those stories has so many complexities, you don't have to think about them for very long to realise how challenging each of those stories is in how do you deal with that as a manager, a detention centre manager, as a person and as a public servant. I went, wait, it doesn't matter how good I am, all of those things are going to keep happening and there's nothing I can do to prevent those sorts of situations occurring. This is time to go. And so I'd resigned, and that was effective the day after I finished on Nauru.
Now, given your experience, Greg, it's a very different experience than a lot of Australians would have had working with asylum seekers. What should the public know that they might not know right now about this issue?
I feel really privileged, actually, to have worked in the job I had for a few reasons. One of them is that I had a real opportunity and in many times took that opportunity up to just sit down with asylum seekers, listen to their stories, ask them questions, ask them about their family, ask them about their story, hear the pain and the joy of their life, listen to their journey and understand a little bit about their circumstances. And that in itself, I think, is a hugely powerful thing for me to have had the chance to listen to. I think the take home, if you like, from that sort of experience is to say that the vast majority of people here, even the ones who may do some stupid things, the bad eggs, as I call them sometimes, are still vulnerable people. They're still people. They're still valuable. We all make mistakes. None of us are perfect. And I think if you have a story like theirs and are put in an environment like that, it's almost inevitable that you'll find some bad eggs. But just because of all that doesn't mean they're not worthy of a voice. Doesn't mean they're not any less or more important as a person than I am. They're valued. They're valued by my God. They're valued by me. And I think they ought to be valued by government policy. And I don't mind who people vote for or what their political allegiances are. I think if you have a political perspective on this that doesn't begin with the inherent value of humans, you'll err. You'll make a mistake with your policy. I'd say that's the take-home message.
It's a very challenging thought, and it's great to get your experience from the inside of this issue. Thank you, Greg Lake, for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.